Welcome to the Better Together podcast, brought to you by the Emergency Services Foundation.
This is a podcast dedicated to supporting and improving the mental health and well-being of the many people, paid and volunteer, who serve our community in emergency management roles.
My name's Susan McKenzie, CEO at the Emergency Services Foundation.
And I'm Sarah Hewitt, ESF's Learning Network Lead.
Today we're speaking with David Younger, clinical and consultant psychologist. The reason we wanted to speak with David is because of his keen interest in storytelling and his involvement with communities impacted by natural disaster and crisis. And he's been very busy lately. So his involvement includes events such as the Black Saturday fires, the 2013 Tasmanian fires, the Gippsland coal mine fire, Wye River Separation Creek, the thunderstorm asthma epidemic, Bourke Street tragedy, and more recently, the Black Summer fires, the COVID pandemic, and the severe flooding in New South Wales and Queensland. You're never short of a job, are you, David, in our environment?
Yeah, regrettably not, and I think it's probably not going to slow down either.
No. Well, thank you for joining us today, David. It's really great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
So can you please start by just telling us about your background and experiences that led you to the work that you're now doing in the area of natural disaster and community recovery?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, what I tend to say is that disasters chose me and kind of just happened. I didn't seek out working in natural disaster recovery, but to take a step back. So, you know, I went straight from high school to uni and finished my undergrad in psych. I'm pretty young and I think did what many young people want to do, and that was to get out into the big wide world and have some experiences and work for a bit. So, you know, I did that for, I guess, close to 10 years after finishing uni. And then I went through a phase of life in my late 20s where, you know, I was faced with some big challenges, some pretty confronting things. And I didn't really fully understand what was happening at the time. But, you know, what in the end ended up occurring was I started to reprioritize, I guess, relationships, priorities, values. They sort of all came into a closer focus. And this led me back to psychology. I sort of reconnected with psychology, I guess, toward the end of this period. So I went back to study, you know, ended up getting registered, but I did all this with a very clear goal of working with and supporting people living in rural communities. You know, I really didn't want to focus on working in the big smokes, so to speak. I think rural communities had always appealed to me. So,
and boy, do they need that support.
Yeah, there was, you know, to me a very, very clear need. So what ended up happening was I set up a practice in Kinglake, and I worked up in Kinglake. I think this was about 2006, 2007 for about a year. I moved off the mountain and set up a practice in Whittlesea, and I hadn't been there really too long, you know, just a year or two, and then the Black Saturday bushfires occurred. And Whittlesea, of course, being close to Hume Vale and the base of Kinglake, but, you know, then bearing in mind that I lived really not too far away from where the fire front stopped, you know, sort of not too far outside of those communities, then I really just kind of got caught up in all of it. And my private practice and, you know, therapy work was incredibly busy and full of trauma for about 5 years. The other sort of key thing that happened there was I saw a real need for health professionals working in the community and supporting community members. So I helped set up a peer support group with one of the divisions of general practice, and then also became a bit involved in community recovery initiatives. So I guess kind of one thing led to another. I met some people that work in the area of disaster recovery, and you know, I guess they were sort of kind enough really to take me on board and introduce me to other work. And really just one thing has led to another. And, you know, so I've been very lucky to be involved in work throughout Victoria and now throughout the country, and just absolutely love it. I love the community work and, you know, working with people and getting to work with those people who are supporting as well. Yeah. So that's sort of how it happened in a nutshell.
That's really interesting. And where did your interest in lived experience storytelling in particular come from?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this. It's been interesting to reflect on it. I think I've always had an interest in stories since I was a young boy. And when I thought about this some more, what I realised is that I never really read a lot of fiction. I actually always read autobiographies, you know, even from primary school age. And I probably, you know, probably means I always had that interest in people and in understanding people and what makes them tick. And, you know, what people's lives are comprised of. So I think that was, you know, a starting point and probably something that pulled me all of the time, I think, towards psychology and towards becoming a psychologist. Once I became a psychologist, though, and started working in therapy and particularly in that post-Black Saturday sort of setting, you know, I became incredibly interested in the impact and the effect of traumatic experiences on people. And then more so how people recover, you know, how do people actually get through big experiences like that? And in particular, people that have, you know, multiple traumatic experiences across the course of their life, you know, some starting from a very, very early age. So I guess the thing here is my interest in lived experience started in a therapy setting because therapy is about listening to personal experiences and journeys and helping people make sense of them. And then I think the other thing was that I started to notice, and particularly in the post-Black Saturday work, that there were some people who were having positive experiences come out of their significant trauma. And again, I didn't realise it at the time, but if I fast forward 2 or 3 years when I went back to uni again to study more in psychology or clinical psychology, actually, that's when I came across post-traumatic growth, you know, the formal term. So growth experiences, and then that became a whole other interest area, lived experiences of growth. And so, you know, I think I've always wanted to understand how these sorts of things occur, you know, what are the underlying mechanisms within a person that enable them to recover or prevent them from recovering or lead to a growth experience. But it's been this constant listening to people's journeys and life experiences, you know, which has enabled me to get a close insight into what people go through. I think then what I've noticed is that over the last few years, people's sharing of lived experiences, you know, maybe in a bit more of a formal way where they might stand up in front of a group of people and talk about that experience. So that's something I've become aware of more recently, as I say, within the last few years. And that's something that's interested me because I really, I guess this leads into probably the next question, but I'm interested in how people can do that safely and in a way that's appropriate and that still provides great benefit for the listener and the audience.
Before we talk about that though, David, can you tell us some examples of how you've used lived experience storytelling in a community recovery situation?
Yeah. I think it's I think this is a really great question. And, you know, we can probably divide this up into sort of two formal areas, I think, sort of informal sharing of stories and then more formal sharing of stories. So you know, what we tend to see, a very common experience, right, in a community recovery setting after a disaster is that communities and the people that make them up, they come together. You know, they come together and they fuse together in a very positive way, generally, because they've been through this massive experience, which is life-changing. And, you know, in Victoria now, we've got this great, I think, very supportive psychosocial recovery system. And what it does is it works to support community members by bringing them together in a whole series of different and creative ways often. You know, and that might be, for example, in the context of arts type projects or just a group of people meeting on a regular basis to have a coffee and a tea, you know, and a chat about things. And so what we've started to notice happen, I mean, I guess this has been recognised for a long time, is that people come together and through the formation of connections and relationships, they form a bond. And over time, the bond strengthens. And as that bond strengthens, you know, they develop a familiarity with each other and a sense of trust, you know, and all of the other ingredients that are important for maintaining a relationship over time. And it's then within that setting often that people start to share their lived experience of natural disaster survival, yeah, or any other aspect. It's not always about survival. It's often also about the whole recovery journey that occurs afterwards. So this is where I've seen it happen quite informally and be incredibly beneficial. You know, that is, we don't necessarily set about thinking about creating settings where people are going to talk about their experiences. They just end up doing it, you know, involuntarily, and it can be of immense benefit for them. The second way, which is slightly more formal and usually occurs a bit further down the track, you know, and this might be in the third or the fourth or the fifth year after the natural disaster, is where you have community members that are actually much further down their personal recovery journey. They've maybe done a lot more work personally or otherwise, or at a minimum, they've done a lot more talking and thinking and self-reflection. And, you know, if I frame it slightly psychologically or emotionally, they've done a lot more processing and digestion. And they've actually started to make sense of this big experience. And usually as a part of that, they've started to create new and different perspectives for themselves about what this big event actually means. And so that the more formal setting will be where you have a community member that does stand up in front of a group of people 3, 4, 5 years down the track and does talk about what they've been through. Or you have a community member or a group of community members that decide to get together and publish a book about recovery. And each person might, you know, write a chapter or make a contribution to a chapter, which is about their experience. And, you know, in this more formal setting that occurs a bit further down the track, what people are tending to do is to sort of outline what worked for them and how they got to the point that they're at. So I guess I'm kind of contrasting here the sort of the start and the beginning, which is a bit earlier on, and people coming together in groups, and then further down the track where people might still come together in groups, but, you know, they're sharing their experience in a slightly different way. So these are just really some of the ways, by no means all the ways, but some of the ways that people share experiences after a disaster.
I can hear that there's, yeah, different ways of sharing stories, different formats. The question I have for you is, is there a particular aspect of lived experience storytelling that you feel is particularly important and that you like to focus on, work with?
Yeah, and I do, and this probably just relates more to my, I guess, my personal and professional interests, but I've been interested in how it works. You know, how does lived experience, that is, how does it work in terms of people sharing their experience, actually a bit more clearly? How do people gain benefit through sharing their experience? And then sort of just flowing on from that, how can people share their experience in a way that is safe? How do we even determine what's safe? Or maybe even before that step, how do we determine and figure out when it might be, you know, suitable and appropriate for a person to share their experience? So I guess, like, I'm trying to get to the core of what actually influences an internal change process in the context of sharing a lived experience, and then when is it appropriate for people to do that, and how can we set them up to do it in a way that is actually safe and helpful and beneficial, not only for them, but for the people that are listening, the audience, or whoever might read a book or whatever it might be.
So that's interesting, because, you know, in the course of our work, lots of people contact me and they want to share a story.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes I think, is it the right time for this person to be sharing a story? So,
yeah,
what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, there is a time when people, you know, may not be ready, or it wouldn't be advisable to share their story.
Yeah, so I reckon that we can, like, expand on this sort of point a bit more, you know, to really, really important point to make, or there's some really important points to make here, actually. And I reckon what we could do is talk about three things in particular. The nature of the issue, you know, or the problem that a person has, the setting, like the setting in which we're considering the sharing of a lived experience. And then I think thirdly, recovery, and in particular what I mean is the stage of their particular recovery journey that they're actually at any particular point in time. So, like, there's absolutely no doubt, right, that lived experience storytelling has many, many associated benefits with it. But if I just unpack this a bit more, you know, natural disaster experiences certainly result in trauma and traumatic experiences, and people carrying with them raw trauma and, in fact, being quite traumatized. And I'm sure the same is very much the case for, I know that the same is very much the case for first responders and people that work in emergency services. So, you know, maybe a starting point, I think, firstly, is to consider whether a person is traumatized or not. And if they are traumatized, you know, what setting are we thinking about them sharing their experience and how far into their recovery journey they are? So in the example of someone who is carrying a lot of sharp raw trauma and is right at the beginning of their recovery journey, you know, or early on into it, I certainly wouldn't want to shut them down from sharing their lived experience. I would really want to encourage them to do it, because that's so important from a sort of a help-seeking and breaking down stigma perspective.
But maybe not in a big audience.
But I wouldn't be encouraging them to stand up in front of a, you know, a big audience for a couple of reasons. And one is that, and, you know, I'm sure many of the listeners out there will know this, but people who do happen to be highly traumatized, which, by the way, is, of course, not everybody who has a traumatic experience, but for those people that are, it's not that we're necessarily so worried about distressing emotions coming to the surface and becoming upset. You know, that's kind of part and parcel of unpacking trauma. But what is concerning is people who, as they begin to talk about their experience, become really disorganized in what they're saying, and really disorganized in how they're feeling and appearing, and in fact can't continue to share their story. You know, they have to stop. And that tells us that they've reached a point really of becoming overwhelmed, you know, and overwhelmed by all of the different ingredients that make something up, like, or make up raw trauma or something like PTSD. And so if somebody's at that point, well, they probably do need to be in a bit more of a professional therapeutic setting, you know, and be supported. Although that doesn't have to be one-on-one, you know, that could be a group setting, for example, and sharing with colleagues who are also at the beginning of their mental health or personal recovery journey. So this is where the, you know, the nature, the setting, and the point that a person is at on their recovery journey is important and needs to be considered.
So that's interesting, because what you're describing there is pretty much what ESF is looking to create through our lived experience program, is to be able to work with people to help them safely share their story for themselves and for others.
Yeah.
And to help them, I guess, understand that they have made sense of the experience and themselves, and they're probably in a place of growth.
Yeah.
And they're not disorganized in what they're saying. They are organized in what they're saying. So that's really what we're hoping to achieve.
Yeah, or even, Susan, and, you know, I was talking about this to a group of mental health coordinators in New South Wales about a month or two ago, who were supporting community members post the Black Summer fires, you know, and want to use lived experience as a way to support community members to heal. And, you know, we spoke about this in great length, and, you know, we sort of all agreed, or I guess the discussion was, that you can absolutely bring people together, and there'll never be a guarantee as to how traumatized they may or may not be until you start to unpack things, unless they're all assessed before they join a group, but that's never going to happen with a community-based activity. So what we then do need are people around who are trauma-aware and can identify trauma, and then can provide support and assistance, you know, as needed, which doesn't necessarily mean like clinical assistance on the spot. That might just mean linking the person into a relevant support, you know, if they're not linked in. So we need people, you know, around in these more sort of informal settings who can pick up on what's happening and recognise it, and link people in with relevant and appropriate supports. But, you know, I guess I'm kind of saying this is the sort of thing that would probably happen and play out more at the beginning of a person's personal recovery journey. If you contrast this with someone who's 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the track and has maybe had quite a lot of formal treatment, although, you know, that's not always necessary, but, you know, may well have had that, and has also had the opportunity to share their experience on multiple occasions. You see what has happened, and this is sort of getting to the mechanisms of what takes place internally. What has happened for a person like that generally is that they have assimilated their traumatic experience, although we can also talk about people just assimilating general life experiences. But assimilation means that I process and digest what I've been through and I make sense of it. And when I make sense of something, I develop a perspective about it. Now, without sort of going on too much here, the essence of trauma in many ways is fractured views and beliefs about myself and the world that I live in. And recovery is about restructuring those fractured beliefs. And that's equivalent to developing new perspectives. So people that are further down the track, you know, not only can they stand up and talk about, or again, whatever the setting might be, their experience without becoming highly disorganized or highly emotional, they can actually very coherently lay out through the use of language and conversation how they work their way through their experience. And that's absolutely vital, because in doing that, what you have the opportunity to do is to create a representation in the listener's mind about what recovery looks like. And this is what people may then connect, may well identify and connect with, and that's what might then motivate them to involve themselves in help and support.
So, yes, and so before Sarah asks, so I know she wants to ask you something, but before she asks that, what we're thinking of in using lived experience with emergency services in Victoria, it's about breaking down stigma.
Yeah.
So it's about saying there's other people out there who are feeling just like me.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is I can see that this person has actually grown through this experience.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea is that it reduces the stigma, but it encourages people to put their hand up for help seeking.
That's right. So this is a great example of someone then sharing their lived experience that has assimilated their experience. They've processed and digested it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas people at the beginning of their recovery journeys generally haven't. But they shouldn't be discouraged from sharing their lived experience. You know, absolutely not. They should be encouraged to share it, but share it in a setting that's suitable with appropriate support.
That makes sense.
Yeah. What I'm hearing is that, you know, the idea that sharing lived experience is a therapeutic process from the beginning, you know, over time. However, it's the context.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is important. So when you're earlier on in your trauma, you're raw and vulnerable.
Yeah.
And in a way, that raw vulnerability is high risk of being re-traumatized, or, you know, through regretting what you might have said in public at some stage, or possibly speaking with certain motivations. It could be more about, you know, be speaking out of anger and so on, you know, retribution. Yeah. Whereas if you can capture people at the end, people who've done the work.
Yeah.
And their public sharing can help people at the beginning.
Absolutely. You know, and over the years, I've had plenty of conversations with people in non-therapeutic settings who were traumatized. And sometimes there have been, you know, colleagues that I've been there with from various settings, not all psychologists. And we come away from those conversations and, you know, we'll talk to each other and say, gee, that person is traumatized. You know, they've got unprocessed trauma there. And you feel it, and sometimes it's quite disturbing. You know, it impacts and affects
chaotic.
You. Chaotic, yeah. So, of course, we don't want that flowing on to other people. It's interesting what you mentioned, the therapeutic value and benefit of lived experience storytelling. So there are studies, there's one researcher in particular, I think going back to the 1980s or maybe the late 1970s, who, and I guess he was a bit of a pioneer in this area, where In early studies, he took uni students, although these were American studies, so they were college students, and he asked them to write and to journal on a regular basis about their traumatic experiences, their adverse experiences in life. So they must have selected students that had this. And within a very short period of time, they found that levels of trauma decreased, levels of well-being improved. You know, there were these, I can't remember them all, but there were these really significant improvements that came from just writing about their experiences, although, of course, they did it in a supported way. So you know, the internal mechanism is one, again, one of processing, digesting and making sense of.
Well, in a way, the very modern tradition of psychology, you know, this is the very origins or the roots in the talking therapy. I mean, yeah. We can go back to the 70s, I think, is that where narrative therapy came about? Where, yeah,
probably.
There's nothing, you know, new in the idea that actually being able to restructure a narrative about your life is a form of healing in itself. And I've seen this, you know, in my own life in such great, you know, a very close friend of mine has had that happen. But even, when we go right back to the origins of the psychotherapeutic Freudian tradition, and we know that Freud's super unpopular now in many ways, but, yeah, that was a great, great truth in his approach. That revolutionary idea that talking and recreating a sense of, it can help recreate your sense of self, and that's the process of healing. And it's done, you know, in relation to another in a safe space at the beginning. Yeah. So, yeah, would you want to speak to that? Anything about the history of this idea?
Or just
what you were saying about this?
Really just agree with you about, you know, narrative and restructuring. You know, that's an underlying mechanism. So, you know, I think what this attaches to is that there's benefit for the person who starts to share their lived experience, you know, and the benefit is probably more so early on and to the midpoint, you know, of sharing their experience. And then there's going to be that point where they've processed and digested and can share it with others, and the benefit, you know, will still be for them, of course, but perhaps more so for the audience. Yeah.
For the audience.
Shift. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's the more recent idea, isn't it? That lived experience has come out of the therapeutic context into the public sphere. And that's the real progress and what so many people, including ASF, are wanting.
Yeah.
Certain agencies have been doing, and something that we hope to get up and running.
Yeah.
So what about, have you ever seen lived experience networks in operation?
Yeah, interesting question. I guess I hadn't heard that particular term, you know, until I think I read your article, Sarah. But, yes, I've seen lived experience networks constantly in a post-disaster setting, and, you know, maybe it gets framed slightly differently, but I would just say it simply gets framed in the context of social relationships or social ties and a social process. The restructuring of a community after a natural disaster event by people coming together who then share their experiences, and I guess, as I said at the start of the podcast, in informal and formal ways. And, you know, information is transmitted through a network, and sometimes, or a lot of the time, that's really helpful and healing for people.
So as we head towards the end of this podcast, are there any other points or issues that you think we should discuss?
Maybe. I think there was something that came to mind earlier on about, we probably haven't touched on it, but recovery.
Yes.
I think recovery is probably something to touch on. You know, the
traumatic growth. Tell us what that means. You know, somebody who's saying they've got to that point of post-traumatic growth.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. So if I could just say first, Susan, you know, what we tend to say in recovery, and I'm sure you say this in emergency services as well, is that recovery is not necessarily an outcome, you know, it's a process. And what we do really emphasise in disaster recovery, but I also absolutely emphasise this for people carrying trauma, is that becoming recovered doesn't equate to reaching a point in my life where everything is back to exactly the way it once was. You know, it's really about adaptation and change and arriving at a point where things are different. But in particular, you know, that in terms of my life, I sort of try to put it this way, that I'm more focused on the present. I'm living more in the present, and I'm also looking to my future once again. You know, I'm starting to plan for the future now. When people are in the midst of recovery from a disaster, they're not at that point. They're constantly looking back. And, you know, outside of a disaster setting, you know, first responders who are carrying trauma, well, generally what they're trying to do is get away from the past. they keep pushing it away, you know, put it back into the box and put a lid back on the box. Well, recovery really is I don't have to do that anymore. You know, I've worked through everything and I'm in the present, looking to my future life is more meaningful and beneficial. To move to your point about what growth is, so perhaps the other contrasting term to use here apart from recovery is resilience. You know, whereas resilience is commonly thought of, I guess, as adaptive flexibility to adverse events, growth is about going beyond where I was at prior to this particular experience. And it depends how technically we want to sort of look at it, but perhaps I'll say this, that there are two dual pathways or parallel pathways that people who experience growth experience. And the first one is of the challenges, the difficulties that come with facing trauma and adverse events. You know, it's difficult and it's hard. The recovery process is not easy. But at the same time, not entirely at the same time, because growth tends to kick in at points further down the track, people can start to have experiences like question their priorities. And I guess this is sort of something I mentioned at the start of my podcast that I did in my late 20s. And people will have a closer look at their values and a closer look at their relationships. And they'll start to change things. Yeah.
There's nothing like a near-death experience to make you value life, is there?
Yeah, or to decide that, you know, what I was doing with my life prior to that experience, I don't want to do it anymore. You know, I want to do something that's meaningful and worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we must wind up now, this podcast. So, David, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and expertise in this important area of lived experience storytelling. A key learning for me from this has been about how there's a transition of where the storytelling can be beneficial for the individual telling the story, and then it can become beneficial for the audience, you know, as somebody moves through their processing of their trauma. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to this Emergency Services Foundation Better Together podcast, which aims to provide you with insights about mental health and wellbeing from experts, thought leaders, and people on the ground.
And if you want to know more about what we do, or better still, support our work to establish a program like this, please go to esf.com.au and you'll see lots of information about Tony's Trek there. And through Tony's Trek, we're actually raising funds for a lived experience program. So if this has resonated with you, you might like to have a look at that. Thank you.